The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm George Day, and I'm going to give you three welcomes. Not one, not two, but three. Because this is a very important evening for me and the foundation that is supporting this and the endowment that is creating the lecture series, and especially to those many, many fans of Isabel Allende. We're going to welcome her properly in a moment. I want to give you a little bit of background about the Free Library first, who my first privilege is to welcome you as a member of the Board of Directors of the Foundation of the Free Library. I'm on the board because I'm passionate about the impact that the Free Library has in the city of Philadelphia. And libraries are an interesting situation in a digital era. So the role is changed to one of facilitating, educating, stimulating, and indeed entertaining. So it's a fascinating time to be part of the Free Library. It's such an important instrument of literacy in the city of Philadelphia. So on behalf of the Free Library Foundation and the Free Library itself, welcome. Second welcome is particularly pointed for me. This is the inaugural lecture of the Barbara Gahn Day Memorial Lecture Series. And it's in honor of my beloved departed wife, who is here in spirit and was a passionate advocate of women's issues. 15 years ago, she funded and founded herself a microcredit bank, has been deeply involved in the plight situation of women in developing countries. So you can imagine how thrilled we were to be able to have Isabel Allende as the inaugural lecturer. So we're very privileged. So my third welcome is indeed to Isabel Allende. And of course, we're celebrating her latest book, The Island Beneath the Sea. But many of you will not have had the privilege of reading it because it just came out. You're in for a treat. In fact, you're in for a treat just to hear her. She's wonderfully articulate and thoughtful. I find her an extraordinarily vivid storyteller. Now, this is a story, as are many of hers, that kind of weaves in magic or magical realism with politics, feminism, and geography, and it's multi-layered and multifaceted. So you can take a lot of different things away from this. This particular story I found utterly compelling. It traces the journey, if you like, of a mulatto slave who became a concubine, but was herself a force of nature, extraordinary woman with a powerful desire for freedom, and that kind of motivates the story along. You will, when you read it, take away different things. I found it absolutely compelling in its portrayal of the savagery of slavery, juxtaposed with the Age of Enlightenment. I mean, what a paradox, because it takes place 200 years ago. I learned a great deal about the history of the Caribbean, and it is particularly helpful, at least was for me, in understanding the current dire situation of Haiti and why it's so difficult for them to recover from the horrific earthquake. So this is a book that, for me, and I think for all of you, works on many, many dimensions. She's a gifted writer. You'll enjoy her. And I want you to welcome her now, firstly, with respect, by turning off your cell phones. Or vibrate. That works, too. And then, would you bring your hands together and give her a big round of applause?
Thank you, thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks. And hello to the people up there also. So before I get started, because I've noticed that nobody said this, I will sign afterward everything you've got. My books, as many of my books as you have. Other people's books. Checkbooks. Whatever you want, but no dedications. Not for my grandmother or my mother on Mother's Day or whatever, because then we never finish. And then you can take pictures, but I can't pose for the pictures because then we stop the line and the flash blinds me. And please, this is for the Hispanics, no kissing. I'll tell you why. It's not that I don't like kissing. It's that I'm doing 13 cities in 19 days, and my experience is that in the kissing, by the end of the tour, I end up in intensive care. I have everybody's germs plus the airplane germs, and I get pimples. So thank you for your consideration. I'm here to talk about my latest novel. It's a historical novel called The Island Beneath the Sea. And I wasn't planning to write this book at all. I wanted to write something about the Pirates of the Caribbean, but Hollywood got the idea before I did. And Johnny Depp made the movie of the book I was thinking I was going to write. So I couldn't write the book. But the idea of writing that book came when I went to New Orleans in 2003, before Katrina, to research for another book, for Sorrow, and I fell in love with the city. And I realized that the French flavor of the city and the voodoo and the cuisine and all that, what makes New Orleans different from any other city in the United States, came from 10,000 refugees that came to New Orleans at the end of the 1700s, the beginning of the 1800s, escaping from what is today Haiti and was then the French colony called Saint-Domingue. It was the richest French colony in the world. And slavery had been abolished in France, but not in the colonies. And the situation of the slaves in Saint-Domingue was atrocious. They had 500,000 slaves, and there were around 20,000 whites, that free people, and around 14,000 free people of color, the affranchis. And the whites were divided in two classes, the Grand Blanc, which were the people who had the plantations and had the money, le Petit Blanc, that were the civil servants, the military, the priests, people who didn't have any money but had political rights and were white. And the affranchis, who were the people of color that had no political rights but had education and usually economic resources that were greater than the ones that the Petit Blanc had. So the Petit Blanc hated the affranchis. On the other hand, the affranchis hated the blacks. They didn't identify with the African mother but with the white father. And they wanted to be as white as possible. So when in the times of the revolution, maybe the worst atrocities were committed by the affranchis against the blacks. The plantations were run by overseers, which were usually also people of mixed race. And the affranchis had to serve in the militia at least 2 years. That means that most of the repression against the blacks was done by these affranchis, by the people of color. My story is about a slave called Zarité, who is obsessed with the idea of freedom, as everybody would be. And in Saint-Domingue, the slaves in the plantations had two choices to escape. One, they could escape to the mountains, if they could manage to do that, and maybe starve to death in the mountains because there was nothing to eat up there, or that death. And when they died, their souls would go to the island beneath the sea, Guinea, paradise. They had come by sea, and they thought that their souls would go back to paradise, to this island beneath the sea. And that's the title of the book. The book is written in two voices. One is my voice telling the story, and the other is the voice of Zarite. And I'm going to read for a little bit. I have censored this very much because I didn't censor it in the National Cathedral in Washington, and people were horrified. So all the raunchy parts I took out, or most of them, and it looks pretty clean now. The first, I always get some fundamentalists in the audience that get really angry. Especially in the East Coast, for some reason. Not to mention Indiana. I will read a little part that is about how the revolution started. The slaves have been revolting forever. And, of course, it had not succeeded. But when there was a moment when these 500,000 slaves, whose life expectancy was 4 to 6 years in the fields because they were exploited to death. There was this rising of all these souls from the island beneath the sea and on the island. And that happened in a forest called Bois Guéman. And this is the moment when it happens. And this is historical. I just wrote it down, but I didn't make it up. Bois Guéman lies to the north. It's an enormous forest, a place of crossroads and sacred trees, where live the spirits of nature and of dead slaves who have not found their way to Guinea, to the island beneath the sea. That night, other spirits came, prepared to fight, because they were summoned. There was an army of hundreds of thousands of spirits fighting alongside the blacks, and that was why finally the whites were defeated. Everyone is in agreement about that, even the French soldiers who felt the spirit's fury. My master, who did not believe in anything he did not understand, and as he understood very little, believed in nothing, was also convinced that the dead aided the rebels. That explained how they could defeat the best army of Europe, the army of Napoleon. The meeting of the slaves in Bois Guéman occurred on a hot night, wet from the sweat of men and of the earth. How was the news passed? The drums carried the message. The sound of the drums travels faster and farther than the roar of a storm, and all the people knew its language. Slaves came from the plantations in the north, and thousands of Maroons descended from the mountains. Gambo arrived with a group of Samba Bukman, a giant who inspired double respect for being a Hungan and a war chief. In the year and a half he had been free, Gambo had grown to a man's size. He had broad shoulders and tiring legs and a machete to kill. He had won Bukman's trust. He slipped onto plantations to steal food, tools, weapons, and animals, but he had never come to Saint Lazare to see me. During that time, my need to be with Gambo was burning me like hot coals. There's no remedy for this love. I tell this with shame. Sometimes, when I lay with my master, I imagine I was with Gambo. I bit my lips to hold back his name, and in the darkness, behind my closed eyes, pretended that the white man's smell of alcohol was the green grass breath of Gambo, who had not yet rotted his teeth by eating bad fish, and that the heavy, hairy, panting man atop me was Gambo, slim and agile, his young flesh crisscrossed with scars, his sweet lips, his curious tongue, his whispering voice. People traveled for hours and hours to reach Bois Guéman, and they all arrived in the dark of the night. The forest was filled with men and women gliding through the trees in total silence, blended with the dead and the shadows. But when they felt the vibration of the first drums on their feet, they were energized. They picked up their pace, speaking in whispers, and then shouts. They greeted one another. They gave their names. A necklace of fires and torches lighted the clearing. The men had prepared the sacred potomitan, a tall, thick tree trunk because the road for the Loas had to be wide. A long line of girls dressed in white arrived, escorting Tante Rose, also all in white, carrying the assom for the ceremony. The drums in the semicircle were calling, tam, tam, tam. Bouguemin took the word to invoke the supreme god, Papa Bon Dieu, and to ask that he lead them to victory. Hear the voices of freedom that sing in our heart, he shouted, and the slaves answered with a clamor that shook the island. That is how it was told. The drums began to talk an answer to set the rhythm for the ceremony. The girls danced, and they sang, calling the Loas, the gods, first Lekbe, and then, as it is always done, the rest, one by one. The drums grew faster, and the whole forest throbbed from the deepest roots to the most remote stars. Then Ogun, the spirit of war, the god of weapons, aggressive, irritable, dangerous, descended and mounted Tante Rose. Everyone saw the transformation. The old woman doubled her size and, with her eyes rolled back, made an astounding leap and landed nearly 10 feet away before one of the fires. From Ogun's mouth came a bellow of thunder, and the Loa danced, rising up from the ground, falling and bouncing back like a ball. Two men approached, the most courageous, to give the Loa sugar to calm him, but Tante Rose, possessed, picked them up like rag dolls and threw them far away. The Loa had come to give a message of war and justice and blood. Tante Rose, mounted by Ogun, picked up a red-hot coal, placed it in her mouth, whirled completely about sucking fire, and then spit it out without burning her lips. Then she took a large knife, went to the sacrificial black pig tied to a tree, and with a warrior's arm cut its throat with a single slash, severing the thick head from the trunk and soaking herself in blood. By then, many followers had been mounted by the gods, and the forest had filled with Loas and spirits mixed in with humans, all scrambled together, singing, dancing, leaping, and rolling to the beat of the drums, walking on burning coals, licking red-hot knife blades, and eating handfuls of hot chilies. The night air was charged, as it is during a terrible storm, but not a breeze stirred. Much later, when the huge crowd was shaking like a single person, Ogun roared to impose silence. The drums immediately stilled, and all those who were possessed, except Tante Rose, were again themselves, and the Loas retired to the tops of the trees. Ogun lifted the assom toward the sky, and the voice of the most powerful Loa issued from Tante Rose's mouth to demand the end of slavery, to call for a total rebellion, and to name the chiefs, Bouguemin, Jean-François, Jeannot, Boisseau, Célestin, and several others. That was the beginning of the revolution. And you, please, I haven't finished. Unless you are bored. If somebody's bored, raise your hand. Okay. This, now I am talking here. In the summer of the following year, one night, Sarité suddenly waked with a firm hand over her mouth. She thought it was finally the attack on the plantation they had feared for so long and prayed that death would be quick, at least for the children, Maurice and Rosette sleeping beside her. She waited without trying to defend herself to keep from waking the children and also from the remote possibility that it was all a nightmare, until she could make out a figure bending over her in the light reflected from the patio torches. She did not recognize Gambo because the boy had changed in the year and a half they'd been separated. But then he whispered her name, Zarité, and she felt a flash in her breast, not of terror, but joy. She raised her hands to pull him to her and felt the metal of the knife he held between his teeth. She took it from him, and he, with a moan, dropped down upon the body that shifted to receive him. Gambo's lips sought hers with a thirst stored up during a long absence. She opened to him, but she remembered the children she had for a moment forgotten and pushed him away. "Come with me," she whispered. They got up with care. Gambo recovered his knife as Sarite closed the mosquito netting to protect the children. Feeling her way, she led him to the mad woman's room on the other side of the house, empty since her death. Arms around each other, they fell upon the mattress smelling of moisture and abandon, and made love in the darkness, in total silence, choked with unspoken words and shouts of pleasure. During his absence, Gambo had found relief with other women in the camps, but he had not been able to sate his appetite for unsatisfied love. He was 17 years old and lived in flames of a persistent desire for Sarite, imagining her at every instant of repose and in every pause in battle and in every misty dawn in the millenary canyons of the Indian chiefs, where he had so many times stood guard. He remembered her tall, abounding, generous, but now she was smaller than he, and her breasts, which then seemed large, fit easily into his hands. Sarite straddled him, bending down to cover his face with kisses, lick his ears, caress him. The air in the... This is all the censored part that I have to skip. So it's a little confusing. If something doesn't make much sense, it's because of the black marker. The air in the room became saturated with the fragrance of lovemaking, with the prudent violence of pleasure, and with smothered moans, silenced laughter, and happy kisses. Perhaps they did nothing they had not done with others, but it's very different to make love loving. Exhausted with happiness, they fell into sleep, pressed together in a knot of arms and legs, stunned by the heavy heat of that July night. Gambo waked after a few minutes, frightened for having let down his guard. But when he heard the abandoned woman purring in her sleep, he gave himself time to lightly run his hand over her, noticing the changes in her body. When he left, she had been misshapen with child. Her breasts still held milk, but they were less firm. Her waist seemed very slim, but he did not remember how it had been before her pregnancy. Her belly, her hips, her buttocks, her thighs were pure opulence and smoothness. Sarite's scent had also changed. She no longer smelled of soap, but of milk. And in that moment, she was imbued with their blended odors. Sarite stretched with a long, satisfied sigh. She was dreaming of Gambo, and it took her an instant to realize that they were actually together, and she did not have to imagine him. "I came to look for you, Sarite. It's time for us to go," Gambo whispered. He explained that he had not been able to come earlier because he didn't have anywhere to take her, but now he could not wait any longer. He didn't know if the whites would be able to crush the rebellion, but they would have to kill the last Negro before they could proclaim victory. None of the rebels was prepared to be a slave again. Death was on the loose and lying in wait across the island. All he could offer was a hard life, but she would not be sorry, because once you taste freedom, you can never turn back. He felt the hot tears on Tete's face. "I can't leave the children, Gambo," she told him. "We will take my son with us," he replied. "She's a girl. Her name is Rosette, and she isn't your daughter. She's the daughter of the master." Gambo sat up, surprised. In that year and a half, thinking of his son, a black boy, the thought that the baby could be a mulatto daughter of the master had never crossed his mind. "We can't take Maurice because he's white, not Rosette, for she's too small to survive hardship," Tete explained. "You have to come with me, Sarite, and it has to be tonight. Tomorrow will be too late. These are the white man's children. Forget them. Think of us and the children that we will have. Think of freedom." "Why do you say that tomorrow will be too late?" she asked, wiping away tears with the back of her hand. "Because the plantation will be attacked. It is the last one left. All the rest have been destroyed. Then she understood the magnitude of what Gambo was asking. It was much more than leaving the children. It was to abandon them to a horrible fate. She turned to him with an anger as intense as the passion of minutes before. She would never leave them, not for him and not for freedom. Gambo held her tight against his chest, as if he meant to pick her up and carry her. He told her that Maurice was lost at any rate, but in the camp they would accept Rosette as long as she was not too light-skinned. Neither of them would survive among the rebels, Gambo. The only way to save them is for the master to take them. I am sure he will protect Maurice with his life, but not Rosette. There's no time for that. Your master is already a corpse, Sarité, he replied. If he dies, the children die too. We have to take all three away from Saint-Lazare before dawn. If you don't want to help me, I will do it alone, Tete decided, pulling on her shift in the darkness. Gambo realized that he could not force her to go with him, and neither could he leave her. Do you think the white man will agree to this? He asked. What choice does he have? If he stays, he and Maurice will be disemboweled. Not only will he accept, he will pay a good price. Wait for me here. And then here is Sarité speaking again. My body was hot and moist, my face swollen with kisses and tears, and my skin scented with what I had done with Gambo, but I didn't care. In the corridor, I lighted one of the oil lamps, went to the master's room, and entered without knocking, something I had never done before. I found him limp with liquor, lying on his back, his mouth open with a thread of saliva down his chin. He had a two-day beard, and his pale hair was wild. Suddenly, all the repulsion I felt for him seized me, and I thought I was going to vomit. My presence and the light took an instant to penetrate the fog of the cognac in his brain. He waked with a cry and with one quick move pulled out the pistol he kept beneath his pillow. When he recognized me, he lowered the gun but did not put it down. "What is it, Tete?" he said with a tone of rebuke and jumped out of the bed. "I have come to propose something to you, master," I told him. My voice did not tremble, nor did the lamp in my hand. He didn't ask me why I had wakened him in the middle of the night. He knew it had to be something very serious. He sat on the edge of the bed with a pistol on his knees as I explained to him that within hours, rebels would attack the plantation. It was useless to alert the overseer. It would take an army to hold them back. Just as everywhere else, his slaves would join the attackers. There would be a slaughter and a fire, and that was why we had to flee immediately with the children, or tomorrow we would all be dead. And that would be a good fate. Worse would be to be dying slowly in horrible pain. "How do you know?" he asked. "One of your slaves who escaped more than a year ago came back to warn me. And he's going to lead us because alone we would never reach Le Cap. The region is in the hands of the rebels." "Who is he?" he asked while he hurriedly threw on some clothes. "His name is Gambo, and he is my lover." He slapped me so hard I was dazed, but when he started to hit me again, I grabbed his wrist with a strength I didn't know I had. Up to that very moment, I had never looked him in the eye, and I didn't know that he had light-colored eyes like a cloudy sky. "We are going to try to save you and Maurice, but the price will be my freedom and Rosette's," I told him, enunciating every word very clearly so that he would understand. He dug his fingers into my arms, and his face was close to mine, threatening. He ground his teeth, and he cursed me. His eyes were bulging with rage. A long, eternal moment passed. I did not drop my eyes. At last, he sat back down with his head in his hands, defeated. "Very well, you will have what you ask. Come, hurry, get dressed, and get the children ready. Where is that slave?" he asked. "He isn't a slave any longer. I will call him. But first, you write me the paper that will free Rosette and me." Without another word, he sat down at his desk, took a piece of paper and hurriedly wrote dried the ink with talc, blew on it, then imprinted his ring on sealing wax, as I had always seen him do with important documents. He read it to me aloud, since I couldn't read. My throat clutched, and my heart began to pound in my chest. That sheet of paper had the power to change my daughter's life and mine. I folded it 4 times and put it in the little pouch I always wore around my neck beneath my blouse. Thank you very much. Thank you, thank you. So now we have microphones, and can we have more light in the... Oh, perfect. And you raise your hand, and we will try to get you the microphone. Question. Don't be shy. There's a hand there.
Somebody else.
We can ask about any of your books.
You can ask about anything you want. There are no indiscreet questions, only indiscreet answers.
I first read The House of the Spirits and then later read Paula. And since there was so much in Paula that seemed to be in The House of the Spirits, I wanted to know, was that based on your autobiography or your life?
When I wrote my first book, The House of the Spirits, my agent said, everybody can write a first book because it's their story. The writer is proven on the second book. And it is true, we tend to write our story first. And The House of the Spirits is the story of a family that resembles my family very much. The patriarch, Esteban Trueba, is very much like my grandfather, although my grandfather was not an assassin or a rapist. But he was very much in character, like Esteban Trueba. And the Clara, the female protagonist, is exactly like my grandmother. My grandmother was crazy, beyond crazy. And she had seances. She had a three-leg table that moved, that the spirits moved. And she spent her life practicing telepathy with three crazy women that lived in the other end of the town. And they would pass telepathic messages with apple pie recipes that never worked. Not because of telepathy, but because they were lousy cooks. And so with that family, I didn't have to invent anything. I just added to my family story and the anecdotes of my family the story of the country and what happened in Chile during that time and what led to the military coup in 1973 and what happened after the coup. So in a way, it's the micro story of the family with the macro story of the country linked.
Miss Allende, I love your writing.
Thank you. I love it too.
Yeah. I really enjoyed reading The House of the Spirits. The movie I saw first, it was the first time I ever saw my husband cry.
Oh.
He was watching it, and he was just beside himself. And so I read it recently for my
Women's
Club. Are
you still married to that wonderful guy?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And so anyway, here's my question, right? Oh, and I love The Sum of Our Days. Oh,
man,
that was so well written. Thank you. Okay, so my question now that you've read this about Zarité, did the master really free her? That's just what I want to know.
Did the master what?
Is he really freeing her? I mean, did what he wrote on the note.
I love that question.
Yeah, what he wrote on the note, is that truly a note of freedom or is it a note saying something else?
Actually, it is a note of freedom, but it has to be signed by a judge. And she doesn't know that.
I knew you were
going to
have something.
Oh, yeah. But you have to read the book because this part is only the middle of the book. So we have another part that happens in New Orleans, and many years go by before she really gets her freedom. But she does get it at the end of the book, and I have to say this because otherwise you won't read it. Yes, there's a lady up there in pink.
Thank you. This book and many of your other books have historical settings, and I wondered if you would talk about how you do the research for those books.
how I do the research for my books. By the way, the people who are up there can hear the questions? Ah, okay, good. What was the question? How do I do my research? It depends. But I love historical fiction because once I do the research of a time and a place, I have half the book. The research gives me the theater where I will move my characters. The story starts to flow when I have all this in my head, all this information about a time and a place. And it's also much easier to see a time from a distance, to see an event with distance. I could have written The House of the Spirits in 1973 after the military coup, but it took me until 1981 and the distance of exile, not only time but also exile, to see my country and to see the events that had happened and be able to write about them. So for me to write about something that happened 200 years ago is easier than to write about something that happens right now because I have more perspective. In the history books, I find what the white man writes, because historians are usually white males. The voices of the poor, the women, the losers, the people who have been defeated, where are those voices in the history books? They are not. So I research in correspondence of the time, memoirs of the time, in travel writing, sometimes documents that you can find. For example, when I wrote Inés of My Soul, which is about the only woman, Spanish woman, that went to the conquest in Chile, there's nothing written about her because she was the captain's mistress, not the wife. And Captain Pedro de Valdivia would write to the king these letters telling him about his conquests and about the other soldiers that came with him, but he never mentioned the mistress because he was married. And so she passed unnoticed in history. So in order to research about her, I went to a trial of the Inquisition that Pedro de Valdivia was accused by the Inquisition, and there were 59 charges against him, and 9 of the charges were because of her. And in those charges, you can see the power that this woman had and the wealth that she accumulated with her brain, because she was very smart. And then I went to the documents of the time in which she sold or rented property. And in those transactions, you also get to know a lot about her. So in those, sometimes what you can't find in the history books, you find in other places. And that's why libraries are so important. Now we have the Internet, which also helps. Be careful with Wikipedia, whatever the name is of that thing, because sometimes they get it wrong. And I have had several mistakes because I didn't check as I should have. And then the other great resource are movies. When they make a movie about a place and a time, they have a team of people researching about stuff that you will never get anywhere. And then you see it in the movie. For example, I wrote a book called Daughter of Fortune about the gold rush. And I spent months watching cowboy movies. Because in the cowboy, it's the time, the same time. You get to see how the towns were, the houses were, how the lamps were, what people wore under the clothes, what the hairdos looked like. All that is so important, and they've already researched it. So that helps. There's a hand in the middle there. Two hands, actually, there. So you can't...
Hi. sorry, we're best friends.
You are friends?
Yeah. In our Spanish lit class, we read a couple of your short stories, and we had a question.
Oh, you are going to ask me what the two words are?
Yeah.
No, I won't tell you.
No, you please, you have to tell us.
Okay.
We know that there don't have to be two words, but we want to know if you had two words.
Okay. I wrote a collection of short stories, the only collection of short stories I have, because to write a short story is much more difficult than writing a long novel. So in one of the stories, the first one is called Two Words, and it's a story of a woman who is a storyteller, and she goes around selling words, selling stories, and for every so many words that someone buys from her, they get two free words that she murmurs in that person's ear, and these two magical words are to be used only by that person. And so the story is about this guy who was a general or something that buys a presidential speech. He wants to be a candidate. And so she sells him the speech and gives him two words. And the words start to work in his head, and he becomes obsessed, and he finally can't live. And being president doesn't matter. He just wants this woman. And so that's the story. And I get every day an email from somewhere in the world saying, what are the two words? Each person has their own two words. They are secret words. But this is something, this is the wonder of imagination and the theater. They made a play in Denver with the stories of Eva Luna. And then they called me and they said, well, we have it on stage and we want the speech that she writes for the general. And I said, well, I don't have the speech. And they said, well, what are the two words? I said, my same answer. You find the words for yourself. And you know how they solved it? The general starts speaking the speech, and from the floor of the theater, flowers emerge, and they open up. And that was enough. You didn't need the speech. Another hand up? Yeah, there's a gentleman there, or a lady next to a gentleman.
I just wanted to thank you so much for sharing your imagination and your heart and your soul through the years of reading. It's just allowed me to escape and to just melt away. And
thank you.
Much I enjoyed it.
You are very kind. This is the only thing I can do. I am unemployable. So you don't have to thank me, really. If I didn't do this, I would starve to death. Here. This man here, can you give him the microphone?
Hi. First of all, it's a pleasure for us to have you in our city.
Thank you.
One question. Do you write your books in Spanish or...
If I write my books in Spanish? Yes.
Or is it all in English?
I wish I could write in English. I write my books in Spanish, and they are translated by a great translator called Margaret Sawyer Peden, who has translated all my books except the first. And I have said to myself there will be a point when I will be able to write fiction in English, but I have been here 23 years, and I can't. I can't. You know, I'm married to a man who thinks that he speaks Spanish. And... That's a problem if you're a writer. So we go back and forth, and when we speak in the same sentence, we can say half the words in Spanish and half the words in English, and he conjugates the verbs in the most awful way, and he makes words that he translates from English and pronounces them in Spanish. I understand everything he says, but then when I'm writing, I'm not clear if the word exists or Willie made it up. So there is a person in Spain called Jorge Manzanilla who takes care of cleaning my manuscripts of the Willieismos in the book. Actually, I shouldn't be saying this about my husband because you'll think he's a jerk. He's really lovely. He's like a wife. Everybody needs a wife. I see that the wives are clapping. Okay, let's take three more questions and make them good. Here's this gentleman here.
I understand that you felt that the boys in your family were more highly regarded than you were, and the mistreatment that you experienced was part of your maturation. And I think we're living in some somewhat interesting times. If I believe what I read, in China, the families all want to have boys and not girls. And that's skewing their society so that in higher education, the men cannot find suitable wives. And in the United States, I understand that women are now far outnumbering the men in higher education. And I'm just wondering, what do you think is going to happen with this? It doesn't seem to be Darwinian. I mean, it doesn't provide for the right kind of coupling, let's say.
Well, maybe we can export American women to marry Chinese men. I don't know. I don't have the solution for this. But what you say is absolutely true, that we still live in a patriarchy where men are more valuable than women, and men values control the society, not feminine values, and that's why the planet is fucked. And we really need feminine energy in the management of the world if we want to save this planet and save humankind. And we need to change that. When I became a feminist, the word had not been invented. I was like 5 years old, and I knew already that I didn't want to live on this planet as it is. And I became a very, very young in my life. I became very angry at the establishment, at the male authority, my grandfather, my stepfather, everybody that was represented authority, because it was all male. And my mother, who was a wonderful woman, very smart, was a victim of the situation. I lived in a household of men, my grandfather and my bachelor uncles and my brothers. My mother and I were the females. And I saw my mother had no money. She had no education to work. She had been abandoned by her husband with three babies. She didn't have a chance. This very smart woman depended on her brothers and her father to support her. And then afterward, she depended on my stepfather. So she was always submissive because she had to be. And I rebelled very young, and nobody knew what the heck was wrong with me. What's happening with this girl? And by age 15, feminist, the word feminist finally appeared in Chile. And then I realized that I wasn't the only angry brat. The world was full of angry women who were trying to change things. So my whole life, and I'm now 67, I will be 68 in August. I look good for my age, but it takes a lot of money. So I thought that by now, the world would have changed after all this struggle. And it has changed for some women, in some places. But for most women, it has not yet. And given the wrong circumstances, women are the first ones to be the victims. Think of Iraq, of Iran, where women were lawyers, doctors, and then suddenly the Taliban comes, and then you are in a burqa in your house, and you can't go out without a male member of your family to accompany you. Places where women can't even drive, and a 12-year-old brat, if he's a male, can drive. So there's a lot to be done. And I have a foundation and the mission of the foundation is empowerment of women and girls. And we deal all the time with what the gentleman said about what is called now feticide. Millions of aborted female fetuses, because male are more valuable and everybody wants males. While what we need in the world is more females, not more males. Anna, a question for her? No.
Yo quiero solo decirte gracias por venir. Somos un grupo de chilenos.
Ah, qué bien.
Que te admiramos. We are a group of Chileans. And I remember you in Chile when you wrote in the magazine Clan, maybe?
Paula.
Paula. And you wrote Civilizando a mi Troglodita.
Yeah. So that was a time where I was a raging feminist.
Yeah.
Now I'm not raging about anything, really. I don't have the energy.
Okay.
Well, thank you. When I was young, I was a journalist, and there was a magazine which was a feminine, glossy magazine, but had some feminist issues in it. And I had a column, a humorous column, in which I made fun of men. And my great fans were men. They thought, and they would come to me and say, I have a friend who is just like that. It was always a friend. Always a friend. The lady in black, please. And that's the last question. Two more then.
I imagine from the power of your work that each work starts with a sense of mission. Do you feel at this time in your career that, and this is, obviously you keep writing because there's a new mission or there's an ongoing sense of mission, but do you feel, have you seen evidence that your books have moved the world in a direction that you would like it to move?
Well, I don't start my books with a sense of mission. I just want to tell a story. I'm crazy about stories, and that's what I want to do. And I never think that I'm delivering a message or trying to change anybody. The person I am eventually can be read between the lines, because I wouldn't be able to write, for example, a thriller about Wall Street, because I have nothing to do with that. It doesn't touch me in any way. It doesn't represent me in any way. It's not my experience. So what I know is what I write about. But I have no mission. My mission is in the foundation that my daughter-in-law manages fantastic. She does a wonderful job. And when I sign the checks that she puts in front of me, that's my mission, to empower women and girls. And if you ask me if I've seen the world changed by my books, no, at all. But some people write to me. I mean, I get a lot of messages now by email. And some people, especially young people, say to me sometimes that by reading my books, they have either come closer to a mother or forgiven somebody or, I don't know. My daughter's mantra was, whenever I called her to ask for advice, she was a psychologist. Good to have a psychologist in the family, especially a family like mine. I would call her for advice, and she would always say, Mom, what is the most generous thing to do in this case? And some people write to me and they say, I have done that. I ask myself, what is the most generous thing to do in this circumstance? And it always works. And you get to be happier with that mantra. It works. Okay, two more questions and only two. Yeah. Yes, over there. My shoes are killing me. Oh, God.
You were asked if you think you have changed the world, but I want to tell you that you have been my companion late at night or early in the morning. You have sat with me in times of joy and times of hardship. You have been a friend without knowing me, and you have given me the opportunity to love my country in a more tender way. Thank you.
Thank you. That's very lovely. That is really lovely. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And on that note, we will finish, because whoever asks the next question will screw it up. So let's leave it there. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.